Good morning and welcome to Lambda Weekly. I'm David Taffet and I'm here in the studio with Laurent Landis and Patty Fink.
Imagine.
The early Patty Fink. And our guest today is Glenn Maxey. Glenn is a former state legislator. He served in the House, in the Texas State House from 1991 to 2003. Before that, he was the original lobbyist for the Lesbian Gay Rights Lobby, now known as Equality Texas, and he is the author of a new book called Head Figurehead, The Search for the Hidden Life of Rick Perry. Rick Perry, a close personal friend of his. You served in his administration, Glenn?
I've known Rick Perry since 1985 when he arrived in the Capitol as I called him in the book, a cotton farmer from West Texas, and the first time I laid eyes on Rick Perry, I thought he was the hottest Wrangler jean wearing West Texas cowboy legislator ever. And of course, at that point, I was just a legislative staffer. But I've known him as a state representative, as the ag commissioner, as lieutenant governor, and then as governor of the state of Texas. His first term of governor coincided with my last term in office.
And we should note, too, that you're the first and only openly gay legislator in Texas.
That's true, with emphasis on open.
Because we're thinking there might be some who served who are not so open.
Past, present, future, I bet.
I never served over the 12 years I was there. I was never the caucus was never less than two. So there were others, people who, for whatever reason, did not decide to be out of who they are because of the districts they represented. And there are still a number of closeted gay folks in the state capitol. Some who have helped the community and some who have only peripherally helped. But, you know, we've never had, as I got there and talked to some of these members, I told them they can represent their districts, they can be closeted, that's their private life. But if they ever went to the microphone and offered an amendment that was harmful to the gay community, all bets are off. And that has a lot to do with why this book that we're talking about today got written. Was about hypocrisy. When I first met Rick Perry back in 1985, he, as I said, was sort of a backbencher legislator. In fact, in the late 80s, when HIV and AIDS came onto the scene, coincided with me being the executive director and the lobbyist for the gay and lesbian community. And at that point in time, Mr. Perry, while he never really voted with us on anything, he was not somebody who was harmful to the community by sponsoring legislation or being on the front or the back mic supporting anti-gay things. In fact, his best friend in the legislature was Dr. Mike McKinney, who was also one of my closest friends, having known him, Dr. McKinney, back long before he came to the legislature in the early 80s in East Texas. And Dr. McKinney was one of the staunchest supporters of our community at that point in time, even though he was a moderate to, you know, conservative East Texas country doctor. Dr. McKinney was our sort of scientist. He was the doctor, the only medical doctor in the house. And he spent a lot of time putting out fires, putting out hysteria, quite frankly. And so he and I used to meet every Friday afternoon in his office to do strategy for the next week on the HIV and AIDS legislation. And being that he was also good friends with Rick Perry used to fly him home on the weekends in his private plane. And so I would always have to put up with State Representative Rick Perry sitting in the outer office yelling at me to hurry up because he wanted to get in the air with Mike. So, you know, we had a casual relationship. We had one of those kind of relationships that never proposed to me that at any point in time would I be having to write a book like this.
And early in his career, Perry was a Democrat. He headed the state campaign for Al Gore in 1988 when he ran against Michael Dukakis. So he really was a moderate Democrat.
Right. I mean, he was sort of a rural moderate to conservative Democrat. And, you know, at that point in time, if I had known any of this, in fact, as we'll talk about the unfolding of this story, I did learn early on about his private life when he was still a state representative. And I have never talked about that for over 20 years because, as I said, I don't have a policy of outing people. And I've always believed that, you know, people's private life is private until you take a right turn into hypocrisy. We didn't see Rick Perry take an anti-gay stance on an issue or speech through his whole time as agriculture commissioner for almost 10 years. 1998, he ran for lieutenant governor. He was lieutenant governor when the first hate crimes bill passed the legislature, the bill that came to the state Senate and was killed using what we call the two-thirds rule. A minority of Republicans killed it at the request of George Bush. George Bush was running for president or about to run for president, and he didn't want to have to deal with this issue, either sign it or veto it. And so Bush had some state senators, 11 of them, blocked the bill in the Senate. Rick Perry was the lieutenant governor. He was presiding over the Senate. And to the best of my knowledge at that time, he had played no role in that. He did not take a position to try to kill that. So we well into George Bush becoming president in 2000. And Rick Perry ascends to the governorship. And in the 2001 legislative session, Representative Sophronia Thompson and Senator Rodney Ellis did yeoman's work for the gay and lesbian community by passing the James Byrd Hate Crimes Act through both houses and getting it to the governor's desk. At that point, there was some doubt that the governor, I mean, he was getting cold feet politically about signing that bill. Ultimately, he did sign the bill. His only request in doing so was that Diane Hardy Garcia, the then executive director of Lesbian Gay Rights Lobby, and any other gay person, including State Representative Glenn Maxey, not be in the room when it happened, when he signed it, not to be in the photographs, which we all said that's a small price to pay to get him to sign this bill.
And even today, that's the only protection we have statewide.
Yes.
Can't kill us.
Can't kill us.
Can't kill us.
Oh, well, they can kill us, but they will get prosecuted.
Charge with it.
Yes. So even that was not wasn't really a right-wing kind of position. We didn't see the veer to the right until actually in 2005, in 2003 and 2005 period, when the marriage equality issues, or at that point the anti-gay marriage equality proposals, the constitutional amendment in 2005, when it passed the legislature, Governor Perry all of a sudden decided that he had to have a signing ceremony. Now, a constitutional amendment's not like a bill. It passes two-thirds of the House and two-thirds of the Senate, and because it's amending the Constitution, it goes directly to the Secretary of State to be certified for the ballot. The people who either okay it or veto it are the people of the state of Texas through an election. The governor doesn't touch it. And yet, Rick Perry, we saw him in 2005 have his first really sort of jerk to the right by having a signing ceremony at a Christian school in Fort Worth.
Along with an anti-choice bill.
Along with an anti-choice bill, yeah. With a passel of evangelical Christians, and made a big to-do out of it. I don't really know what he signed that day. He signed probably just the back of a
napkin
or something, but it had nothing legally, nothing legislatively to do with passage of the bill. But clearly he was wrapping himself into that sort of political cocoon. And then as he became a candidate for president in the last couple of years, I have to say that, in my opinion, he clearly is the most anti-gay candidate running in the flock of I don't know the term I want to call them.
The clown car,
that's a good time, of candidates are running for the Republican nomination right now. But everything from the Personhood Amendment to reinstating Don't Ask, Don't Tell, to using marriage equality as a wedge issue. And because of that hypocrisy, it brings me back to the things that we talk about in the book.
And even yesterday, Rick Perry went even further hard right and said that he is against all forms of abortion, even in cases of rape and incest.
Well, no.
In the life
even
of the mother.
In the case of the life of the mother, because he's so pro-life, he wants her to die.
It's just amazing. I think he's a desperate man, but that's above and beyond his hypocrisy.
So with that background of me out of office now for right out of a decade, I left the legislature in 2003 after redistricting. I was redistricted out by Karl Rove and friends after campaigning around the country against George Bush.
As was Harriet Earhart.
As was our good friend Harriet Earhart. So I've been out of office for about a decade, and as good retired people do, I mostly have been spending my time sitting in my underwear playing on the internet, just doing those kinds of things. I don't have a job anymore. I have a great legislative retirement. That's another issue we could talk about, but I do get a nice check from the taxpayers. And so I was actually writing my memoirs and writing the story of my time as a legislator, as a gay activist, as an AIDS activist. I have a story to tell because I lived through the beginnings of the modern GLBTQ community in Texas, and so I thought those stories need to be written down. So I was in the midst of that. And back on June 23rd, my phone rang with a national reporter. It was the first of many. I talked to dozens of reporters. They all were calling in saying, we hear that your governor is thinking about running for president. He's planning a great prayer palooza, as I called it, the great response, which was a religious rite prayer service at a football stadium in Houston. And he was saying that he might run for president. So people were calling me and saying, who do we talk to about a myriad of issues? I sort of am a Texas Rolodex. Having done the George Bush campaign, I was in everybody's Rolodex. So as people from the Washington Post and the New York Times and Salon.com and Huffington Post, on June 23rd, the phone rang, and it was Jason Chirkus of the Huffington Post. And he said, hey, it looks like your governor's running, and do you know anything about these rumors about his private life? And I actually said to him, well, I only know a couple things. I know about the rumors, the story from 2003 and 2004, which hit the Burn Orange Report back then, which is a blog based in Austin, started by University of Texas students. And the Burn Orange report had said that Anita Perry had hired a divorce attorney, that she had caught Governor Perry with a young man who is his Secretary of State, a guy named Jeff Connor. And that story got so hot, everybody was talking about it. It was all over the political news. If you went into a bar, you talked about Rick Perry getting caught by his wife with a guy. And it got so bad that Rick Perry asked the Austin American-Statesman reporter Ken Herman to do an interview, ask him to interview him so that he could be asked the question and talk about that this was all untrue kinds of things. So I told the reporter, I know what everybody else knows about Jeff Connor. I mean, I've never really asked any information. However, I do have a personal story that back in 1989, and specifically in 1990, right after Oil Can Harry's, a gay bar in Austin, opened, I had on four occasions that I distinctly remember have guys walk up to me and say, hey, aren't you the lobbyist at the Capitol? And I would always say, yeah, sure. And they say, do you know that cute state representative from West Texas? And I would say, which one? Because there were several. I had noticed there were several. And they would all say, Rick Perry. And I said, oh, yeah, I know him. buns of steel. I mean, I would say something like that. I mean, because he was hot. And they would always say, hey, I'm hooking up with him. Or, you know, on one occasion I recall somebody saying, you know, my best friend is hooking up with him. And I always would say, lucky you. And I would let it go because, as I said earlier, you know, he was inconsequential. Cotton farmer from West Texas, what he did in his private life, in his marriage, was his business. And as I said, he was not harmful to the gay community any more than I would give a pass to anybody else who was working in a rural district. Perhaps voted wrong, but he wasn't harmful. And so I just let it pass. I never asked those guys their name. They weren't people I even knew. You know, you just file that away and say, well, that's curious. So I tell Jason those two stories.
Yeah, I have to say I'm a little surprised, and we talked about this a little bit before the show, why hasn't this come out? These rumors, why haven't they come out in the midst of choosing a Republican for the Republican nomination? And especially when you look into what happened to Herman Cain. Everything came out, whether it was true or not.
Herman Cain was harmful to people, and Rick Perry wasn't harmful to these people that he picked up with.
That the story sort of took a funny twist for me. As I said, I was sitting around just playing on the internet, writing my memoirs, and so I hung up the phone with the reporter after telling him the story of Jeffrey Connor that everybody knew, and the story of the random guys who'd walked up and told me this 10 years prior. I thought, you know, maybe I should. It would be a great chapter for the end of my book just to go see if any of this was true. Now, I'm sort of well-placed to do this research. I've been around the Capitol for over 40 years. I know everybody in the Capitol. I know gay people because of my work in the gay community. And these situations overlapped very nicely. The second piece, why this was different than finding these people, these guys, than ever before, is that the internet and Facebook became a huge tool in doing this kind of research. So that afternoon, I literally, I just have to tell this whole story of the first day because it was so dynamic. I literally made a mental note, like, let me think of every gay person that I've known who's worked in the Capitol since 1985 that I knew, mostly closeted, and it was legislators, it was legislative aides, it was reporters, it was lobbyists, it was hangers-on. And so I began my very first was I sent an email to a retired statewide reporter who worked for a state newspaper who's now left the Capitol and is now out as a gay man. So I sent him an email and said, hey, do you know anything about the Perry rumors? And he sent me back this great email that said, well, if I did, I'd write a story for the Huffington Post. And I said, well, actually, I'm working with the Huffington Post. And do you know anything? And he said, well, you know, we have a mutual friend, you know, a friend that throws a big AIDS fundraiser every year. He said, you know, he told me this wild story about back in the early 2000s, around 2003, of being in a bar where a young man walked up to him and his friend, and they started a conversation, and the guy had said, I've just been hired to go play with Rick Perry and an aide at the Driscoll Hotel. And he went on to tell the story of that they had he had been hired 3 or 4 times a year. And he's the guy, when I said, wow, you know, wow.
What can you say to that?
And so what was interesting is I said, well, to the guy, do you think we can find this guy? And he says, yeah, I know his first name, and I think he's still in the business. And so within about an hour, probably by about 9 o'clock that night, I had another younger friend. I had to go back into the kids in their 20s to say, hey, can you search the internet and find a male hustler named Joey? And what I'm talking today, I'm talking in the pseudonyms that I gave these people in the book. And so this friend came back within 10 minutes with two sites, Adam for Adam and rentaboy.com, that both had ads from this young man. had pictures. Had pictures. Let's cite that. And had his screen name, had his email and his phone number.
And we need to take a break. We're talking to Glenn Maxey. He's a former state representative. He wrote the book Head Figurehead, The Search for the Hidden Life of Rick Perry. Glenn is going to be at Tape Lenders later this morning from about 10 to 2, signing copies of his book. If you'd like to pick up a copy of the book, talk to Glenn. You can see him over at Tape Lenders, which is over on Cedar Springs at Throckmorton. We'll be back with more Lambda Weekly right after this.
I started going cold turkey. Well, at least when I'm in the car.
I know I shouldn't do it, but it's so hard to stop. That's why I hide it from myself, so I won't be tempted.
I used to do it all the time. I stopped by locking it in my glove compartment.
My friend used to do it way too much. Now I turn it off when we're in the car.
My solution is simple. I just don't do it.
There are lots of ways to stop yourself and others from texting and driving. How will you stop? Tell us at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
KNON thanks Bayer Imaging Copier Solutions for their support of KNON. Bayer Imaging Copier Solutions provides KNON all our copy services. Bayer Imaging Copier Solutions sells, leases, rents, and services a full line of color and black and white Canon copiers with scanning, printing, and faxing capabilities. Bayer Imaging Copier Solutions offers wholesale packaging back to the consumer market in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. Overstock, demo models, and used equipment with full warranty is available. For more information, 214-431-5191 or BEYERImaging.com.
You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM HD1 in Dallas and Fort Worth, the voice of the people.
And you're listening to Lambda Weekly here on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm Dave Taffet here with Patty Fink and Lalon Landis. Our guest today is Glenn Maxey. He's the author of the new book, Head Figurehead, The Search for the Hidden Life of Rick Perry. Glenn is going to be over at Tape Lenders later this morning, starting about 10 o'clock, signing copies of his book. He'll be there till about 2, so if you'd like to stop by, if you're walking there, be careful. Another pedestrian was hit this week. Another one, yes.
Oh, wow.
But be careful crossing that street. But he will be at Tape Lenders signing copies of the book, and we're just talking about how did that whole story get started, and how did you find these guys? One of the questions that's come along through the years, because over at the Dallas Voice we had those stories, we reported on the rumors, and we never could find the right person. And you told us how you were able to find the right people. You just had the right connections. Why did all these people keep quiet all these years about it?
Well, let me just sort of finish this first day, and then we'll come to that. So, as I had said, I had this, the guy I call the gay businessman, tell me of meeting this young hustler. We had then found him on the internet, and I sent my second email about 10 o'clock that night to a former, what I call the Capitol insider, a high-level person in government, actually. He's now out of office. And his first response back was, I don't know anything from back the time that I was around Rick Perry. But I was at a dinner party just recently, and this young man told me a story about a male hustler. And I said, and do you know his name? He said, I can find out. And within 10 minutes, he called me back, emailed me back, and said his name is Joey. Now, what are the chances that the first two people, who don't even know each other that well, responded that they both had heard a story about a male hustler named Joey? So by the next day, the reporter that had called me, I'd given him the names. What I learned in the very first day was that it did me no good to talk to these people, these guys, is that the reporter had to hear directly from them or he could not report on it. So I began just being what I called the best investigative reporter on the planet or the most fabulous gay gossip queen ever. or both. And so I just continued. I actually used Facebook and sent Facebook messages to approximately 300 or 400 people. And when somebody would give me a lead, I would go on Facebook and find that person's name and find his friends, and I would talk to his friends. And the stories began rolling in. We found a person while we were at a gay bar at happy hour, we were just talking to the bartender and people walking in, the reporter and I, who was in town for a week, and somebody, the bartender basically said, "Oh, everybody thinks Rick Perry's gay." And the reporter said, "Why do you think that?" And he said, "Watch, I'll ask the next 10 patrons who walk in." So the next 10 patrons who walked in.
Empirical experiment.
Empirical experiment. All 10 of them said, "Oh, yeah." Now, most of them told the Jeffrey Connor Secretary of State story. But about the fifth or sixth one said, "Oh, darling, of course he's gay." I said, "How do you know?" He said, "Well, I was at a gay party with him." And, of course, I said, "How do you know it was a gay party?" And he says, "Well, you know, it wasn't the kind of party where everybody took off their clothes or anything, but it was all gay people, and it was the 80s, and there was some cocaine. Must have been a gay party." So then I said, "Well, how do you know Rick Perry? Just because you went to a gay party didn't make you gay." And he said, "Darling, you know, Rick Perry came in with the guy who had his little finger in his belt loop, and the belt loop guy never turned loose all night long. I think they were together." And so that was, just sort of shocking to me. And that was the early 80s. The guys I talked to were in 89. I sent an email to a prominent attorney, and he sent back an email who said, "Oh, yeah, I know somebody who had sex with Rick Perry. Picked him up on the jogging trail. They went back to his house." I talk about that person in the book at length. That's the person who ended up not having been picked up on a jogging trail, but was somebody who actually answered a Craigslist ad. And that story is the one that's the most explicit in here, because this person told the reporter in great detail about the sexual hookup. So it became just, sending emails out, friends saying, "I've heard a story." This book is written in a very humorous kind of way, because it was a wild kind of thing. You know, as I said before, I had the reporter and I were exchanging emails, 20 or 30 times a day. By the time the reporter story was killed at the Huffington Post, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a second, but by the time the story was killed, I had, because I was writing my memoirs, I kept the emails in a running Word document. I would cut and paste them every night, just sort of for history's sake. And I was at over 3,000 emails and text messages by this time. I had had a two-month running text message conversation with Joey the Hustler. I'd talked to hundreds of people.
One would think that you were 22.
You would think.
All that texting and emailing.
It was very new for me, let's just say. I had never had that, had probably not texted more than 100 times, and then all of a sudden I had a young man who was very naive, but very believable. As we went through this process, in order to get Joey to talk on the record, I've learned of his, he states at one point, "Life is a precious thing. Why should I tell this story?" He also expressed that he knew that by telling his story that he would be out of business, because this young man is works the circuit here in Texas. He's in Dallas a lot. He's in Austin, lives in Austin, but he spends about half his time here in Dallas. He was only 18 and 19 when he hooked up with our governor. And so he's not done anything else. And so he knew that telling his story, and he actually expressed that to his attorney at one point, that telling his story, he understood the importance of it now, but he actually didn't understand the importance of it as I was talking. I'd already been talking to him for almost 6 weeks when I got him his attorney. It took me forever to get him to get the attorney, sign up the attorney, meet the attorney. His attorneys then thought the story was so hot and so believable that they got him Gloria Allred, the nationally known attorney for these kinds of cases, media frenzy cases. But as I'm talking with him, at one point he says, "Do you really think this is going to have any legs? The last time this story came up, as he stated it, it was up and it died in one day. Of course, it didn't. From his point of view, he heard about it and it was gone.
Right.
Back in the Secretary of State story. And I said, he is, in a text message, he's leading in the polls to be the next president of the United States. This was when Perry was at the very top. And his response back to me, he was, oh, I'm the least political person you might ever meet. I didn't even know he was running for head figurehead.
Ooh, there's the title of your book.
And there's the title of the book, because I said, as naive as he was about what was going on around him, the fact that he didn't even know that Rick Perry was running for president after I'd been talking to him for 6 weeks, he's evidently thought I was just still talking about some low-level elected
official. Yeah, I mean, most of us would know if somebody that we were in close contact with was running for president.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. He was very naive about this stuff. But I say in the book, maybe he's not so naive. If he's figured out that the president of the United States is only a figurehead, he might be very sharp, quite frankly. You asked the question about how I was able to do this. I think most of it, the reason I was able to do it was, and still am doing it, is that people know me from 40 years in politics. I worked in over 100 political campaigns, and have done, I think, a good job for the gay and lesbian community back in the bad old days. And so I have a reputation as somebody that has a level of trust. I'm not doing this as a lark. I didn't write this book to make money. I wrote this book because I had no other outlet at the time that the story got killed at the Huffington Post.
I was happy to see you do this work, because if there's some substance behind it, and people need to know that this guy who is governor of Texas and it daily has leaned further and further right at our expense. He's using us day in and day out to gain votes for his own personal political gain, to come out of Iowa ahead and sustain his campaign for the presidency. And that pisses me off.
Yeah.
In a way that...
Clearly.
Do you think I don't think he's going to, but if he is to get the nomination, do you think this will finally come get to the national press?
The only negative, this has not moved into, the hot story like the Herman Cain story. And in some ways, I talk about that in the book, of why that happened. Let me just step back and talk about what happened with the story. As we proceeded with the story, after a number of weeks, the Huffington Post was going to write the story, but I had found three or four more guys. And then we delayed while we researched the additional people and learned more about them. Then as we got further into the fall, Perry's has announced for president. He's rising in the polls. As I told you, Patty, early on, we were going to write the story before the prayer event. Then it was going to be right after the thing. Each time it was like, oh, we've got more stories to tell. I speak in the book of the ultimate time when the story has been approved by all the journalists at the Huffington Post, and it is sent over to the Perry campaign for comment. It went over to the Perry campaign for comment on a Thursday. The next day, Lynn Wood, the national libel attorney, the same attorney that Herman Cain had speaking on his behalf, was hired by the Perry campaign and threatened the Perry campaign, the Huffington Post, with a lawsuit if they printed the story. That caused a delay because the Perry campaign said, we want to have a couple weeks to refute the charges. I threw a fit at that point, and as I said, there's no way the Perry campaign can refute these charges. Only Rick Perry, sitting across from the reporter and his editors, could refute these charges. And I said, preferably with a lie detector connected to his little appendage. I was that frustrated that they thought that somebody at the campaign can say, oh, he didn't have a Craigslist hookup, or he didn't hook up with Jeffrey Connor. I mean, how would they know? I mean, he was the only one in the room other than the guys he was with. So the story became then, after the delays of trying to get the Perry campaign on the record, that they delayed it for a number of weeks. Then there was a big hurricane on the East Coast, and that delayed it into September. Ultimately, we didn't think, or the Huffington Post kept saying, if one of the guys goes on the record, the Craigslist guy ultimately went on the record with his first initial and last name, and we had every belief that Joey was also going to go on the record. As I talked to him, he was hesitant, and I decided that he needed to have an attorney. I had a bank of attorneys already because I was in the book with my claims about the 1990s. So I suggested he get an attorney. It then took us weeks to get him to agree to an attorney because he was very naive, like, this is just going to blow over. Finally, I got him the attorneys. That delayed it because then the attorneys, it just kept getting delayed and delayed. I got so frustrated. By this time, I'd already talked to the New York Times and Salon.com and three or four other people who had all the outline of all the stories, but none of the names. And so I got so frustrated with the Huffington Post that I said, look, Joey's never going to sign an affidavit. So let's just do the story. You were going to do it without an affidavit weeks ago. What's the deal? We were after the holy grail of an affidavit because they knew that that would just really seal the deal. So then they decided that they would do the story. And they would do the story based around me, make me the character that found the guys and explain the conversations I'd had through text messages with Joey, the fact that he had a national attorney. National attorney had briefed, had Texas attorneys brief, I learned this, that Texas attorneys had briefed both statute of limitation on prostitution and on cocaine use. And so they were going to write the story. It was approved by, the reporter submitted it. It was approved by his editor and by Howard Fineman, who's the chief journalist at Huffington Post. And then went to Arianna Huffington. They said, she's in Europe. She can't read it till Tuesday. This was Friday, and I threw another fit and said, New York Times is getting the story tomorrow. So Arianna read it overnight on her BlackBerry, I guess, and I was told she's approved it. She likes the story. And so on the next Monday, I called the reporter, and the story was going to run on Tuesday. And I said, look, I've bought locks for the door. I've done my laundry. I've bought groceries. I'm in a bunker.
To an undisclosed location.
Well, I did. I ended up going to an undisclosed location after the book. But at that point, I said, it's imminent. Is it? And she said, we'll hold up because Arianna's pulled the plug. She talked to the attorneys or the corporate office, which is AOL on Huffington Post. And they have killed the story. Or she's pulled the plug, but after conversations with him. My supposition, my indications through conversations was that she had cold feet about being sued. And so the story got killed. I then spent time with Esquire magazine, with Mother Jones, with Austin Chronicle, and everybody was back into the point of saying, we'd have to have affidavits. And then everybody said, we need to re-interview all of these men.
Oh, gosh.
And I was going like, God, you know how difficult it was to get people to talk about having sex? A, having sex. B, having homosexual sex. C, knowing it's going to be in the national news with a presidential candidate. It all starts again. And I thought, I can't go through all of that again. And so I did this book for a number of reasons. Number one, I wanted to put the story out there enough that maybe other reporters will look at it. B, I used pseudonyms throughout this book. I could have named these people, but I put used pseudonyms because I believe that one of them will come forward or other people would come forward. This book has been out for only a couple weeks, and I have five new leads, and including one who came in since we last talked, Patty, overnight.
Wow.
Somebody has sent me an email about his name. This was not a sexual hookup, but this was where Governor Perry hit on him to the point of him knowing it was a sexual.
And we're talking to Glenn Maxey. He is a former state legislator. He's the author of the new book, Head Figurehead. He's going to be at Tape Lenders on Cedar Springs later this morning signing copies of the book. You can meet him over there. We're going to continue talking to Glenn right after this.
Follow KNOWN on Twitter at KNOWN893FM.
Follow us now.
Be the first to find out about KNOWN events and get updates on KNOWN. That's KNOWN893FM on Twitter for updates on benefits, programming, and more.
If you don't want your old SUV or other gas guzzler, the KNON Vehicle Donation Program can take it off your hands. Call us today at 877-KNON-AUTO or donate online at KNON.org. Our representative will take all of your information and arrange a convenient time to pick up your vehicle. All it takes is a call to 877-KNON-AUTO and we'll create great programming from your old car, truck, or boat. 877-KNON-AUTO.
You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM HD1 in Dallas and Fort Worth, the voice of the people.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Patty Fink and Laurent Landis. Our guest is Glenn Maxey, the author of Head Figurehead. It's the search for the hidden life of Rick Perry. Glenn's going to be over at Tape Lenders on Cedar Springs from about 10 to 2 this morning. Well, not 2 in the morning, from 10 this morning till 2 this afternoon, signing copies of the book. He'd rather it was 2 in the morning because he would be more awake, but he is awake now. Not your normal schedule. Patty.
We were talking before the break about, you know, aspects of this book and the real arc of it. You know, the story and then the attempt to tell the story in the mainstream press. But I thought one of the most telling points in your book was when you talked about your assertion that Rick Perry is not gay. Talk a little bit about that, because I think that's so interesting.
Well, as I wrote this, we all use the shorthand about genital sex and same-sex relationships as gay sex. But as I wrote this book, or as I researched this book, one of the number one reasons that the Craigslist hookup, James the Jogger, why he didn't want to be in the story, he told the National Reporter, was that he didn't want to embarrass the gay community. He didn't want to be out there as somebody who had an anonymous hookup with someone through Craigslist. He thought that would denigrate the community. As I talked to a lot of people flippantly said, oh, you know, do we have to claim Rick Perry? And so I put a serious thing in here about that Rick Perry's not gay, in my opinion. The term gay, as we have developed that word over the last 30 or 40 years at least, to me means someone who is self-actualized, somebody who has self-respect about their sexual orientation, someone who has emotional relationships with people of the same sex, all of those kinds of healthy, nurturing, self-actualizing feelings. I believe that there are a lot of people in our community who have, and let's just say anonymous sexual genital sex, feel-good sex, and I'm not denigrating that. People have done that since Adam and Eve, if you believe in all the way back, that in my mind, in the context of this book, is what I would call random homosexual sex acts. You know, that I don't know about Governor Perry, you know, whether in any of these relationships he had a feeling for the guys, an emotional context to it. I sort of think that in one case, but it's for him to say, I'm gay. It's not for me to put that term on him, because until he affirms that to himself and to the public, you know, then these are just homosexual hookups.
Right, and I agree with that. Absolutely agree. Because he's actually married to a woman who he's been married to and, you know, fathered children with. And so his choice, it seems, is to maintain that while having sex with men.
It's funny that when you said about his marriage, the very first comment the Perry campaign made in the press about this was in a Politico.com story, an e-book that they put out about a month ago, right before my book was published, where they talked about a high-level Perry person said when Jason Cherkis, the Huffington Post reporter, had come to Austin and was asking questions, they went into what they called DEFCON 9 about him asking the questions, which I thought was an interesting thing for the Perry campaign to tell Politico.com. But also there, a high-level Republican spokesperson for the Perry campaign, at the Perry campaign, said, well, you know, he can't be gay. He's been married to Anita for 29 years. And I was thinking,
we've heard a lot of those lines before.
Wow. And that, I mean, on top of all of the sexual abuse things with the football coaches and all that stuff, and I thought, anybody to use that line in 2011, this year especially, that knows that acting out sexually has nothing to do with sexual orientation. It has a lot of other complex things going on. But I thought that was a strange line.
No, I was just going to say, I have to disagree with you and Patty on that. I'm not saying that I think Rick Perry is gay or not either, but in general, if you're having sex with someone of the same sex,
it's a good indication.
It's there. A good indication that you're at least not straight.
Well, I'm not making the statement about the orientation. I'm talking about the word gay,
right.
The use of the word gay.
Well, and I think, you know, we know that once... behavior, one's sexual behavior, does not define one's orientation, and I think that's a strong point here. And I think if we were to claim him, that we sort of undermine who we are, because, you know, I'm in a long-term relationship with my partner. We own a home. We have pets. We take out the trash. We do our jobs. We go visit family at holidays. We do all of those things, and that's not what gay
is doing. That's the positive side. That's, you're someone who accepts you, who accepts themselves. But I mean, we know politicians. There have been gay politicians out there, like the former governor of New Jersey. I mean, he finally did come out and say that he was gay.
There was the reason that one of these people didn't want to come out with the story. And over the years, you would think that over the years, more of these stories would have come out from, in one form or another, as more than just rumor. Yeah, and that one of them would have gone to the press. I think, like with Herman Cain, some of those stories blew up because he wasn't good to these people. I mean, these were attacks.
Well,
In Perry's case, these were absolutely not attacks. They were completely consensual. So he's not being accused of doing anything like harassment or or anything
coercive.
Like that. Yeah, there was nothing coercive. You know, absolutely not being accused of anything.
I totally
like
agree with that.
Yeah.
And not in the several dozen stories that I've learned about, do I find anything?
Several dozen.
Yeah. Not, you know, when I say several dozen, some of these are just people saying he approached me, you know, kind of deal. So these are not all sexual situations. Not all of which the people that I could get past the person who said, I have a friend, and the friend then wouldn't talk to me, you know. So, but I'm in several dozen of those situations, including five since the publication of the book, five new ones. Just to go back, and the criticism I've gotten a little bit about this is that, oh, these are still just rumors. I just want to restate that the legislator in this book, I've known for 35 years, and I talked to four of his closest friends who all told me that he had told them the story over the years. The Craigslist hookup, I found out his name inadvertently through this. It's somebody I've known for 22 years. He's a local businessman, and Jason Cherkis of the Huffington Post interviewed four of his friends who he had told within 24 hours of the event. I've known that guy for 22 years. He actually had been, he and his partner had been contributors to my campaign on four occasions. Jeffrey Connor, the Secretary of State, I've known when I was in the legislature. I've known him for well over a decade. So these aren't just random people I found, you know, under a wood pile somewhere. These are people that I know through my own relationships. I know their friends. Their friends, you know, told stories. So as I've gone through this, at one point in the story, I use an example. All the conversations in this book are the actual emails back and forth. If I had a phone conversation with somebody, I sat down and I typed it up and sent it to the reporter. So I have pretty much a log of every conversation I've ever had on this topic. It was in 6-point type. It's about 800 pages if you were to try to print it out in the Word document that we began the book off of. So there's a lot more than what's in this story.
But you say right up front, I think even on the blurb that's available on Amazon where you're selling your book, that you ask the reader to decide for themselves. You put it all out there, say you decide.
I used this when we were chatting before we went on the air. This story, in reading the book, because I don't use people's actual names yet.
Very primary colors.
I don't use people's actual name yet. Meaning that someday we might. It just sort of tells a story, and the repetition of the story gives it some value. I state in the book that I believe, and I think I know through conversations with all of these people, that Rick Perry has had homosexual relationships. You can make your own decisions. People say, well, you don't, in the critiques of this, it's if you don't have somebody, first person by name on the record, then none of it's true. But I've been using the analogy of the Casey Anthony murder trial, that in that trial, we all saw this evidence. We saw lots of evidence, lots of circumstantial evidence, but a lot of stuff that led all of us to believe she was guilty. A jury looked at it and said, well, we don't have the very finite proof to make the leap between these circumstances and guilt. So they found her innocent. We all were said, whoa. Sort of the same thing here. I think that there's enough here that anybody would conclude. I mean, when you find 28 independent people who don't know each other all telling a story or different stories, after a while, and especially as I point out in the book, when the guy who called himself that Perry was his sugar daddy, that was a close personal friend of mine who gave us this person. I called him, I emailed him, I got no response. Reporter goes to his door. He says, I don't want to talk. And then a month and a half later, another newspaper reporter reports that he knows somebody. Where another reporter actually talked to him, and the guy had said at a party, I had sex with Rick Perry. Totally independent, but it's the same guy. And you think, well, how can this be? You know, how can I have two independent people both talk about Joey the Hustler, who never had met? And then I actually, you know, met Joey's roommate. He's talked on the record to the reporter by name and told lots of stories. So there's three or four people who know Joy very well. So I just now let the public decide, and hopefully soon I will have somebody who wants to go on the record. Because the presidential campaign may be over for Rick Perry in a matter of weeks, but he's still going to come back to Texas. He's still going to be our governor. We go through at least one more legislative session with him. And there's already talk on the internet of Rick Perry coming back and running for another term. And so I think the gay community has a lot to fear about him coming, limping back to Texas and being sort of the, you know, wounded dog that will bite somebody. And now he's surrounded himself with the Christian Coalition, the evangelical movement, all the anti-gay leaders that he brought to Houston, to the Prayerpalooza. All those people are now his best friends, and they will expect him to deliver when he's back in Texas, if not in the White House.
Going back to this story, getting into the national press, wasn't it earlier this year that Larry Flint took out a page? I think it was an Austin American Statesman. Tell us what you know about that, about offering $1 million for proof.
Well, it's sort of, let's just say that there's fine print with Larry Flint. because I think that Joey has gone down that trail. I suggest that he went down that trail. The fine print was basically you have a picture, you have DNA, you have...
concrete proof. It had to be not just a story.
Yeah, you had to have concrete proof to get that $1 million. The amount that organization was willing to pay for just somebody telling their story was peanuts. So it wasn't exactly as dynamic as it looked in $1 million for anybody who had sex with Rick Perry. Because I wouldn't have several dozen millionaires walking around if they could just do that. So we go forward. We'll see what comes forward.
And we know, too, that the Iowa caucuses are basically a week away. They're on the 3rd of January, which is next Tuesday. So before we're on the air again, we'll see what happens in Iowa. But, you know, who knows what's going to happen with the Perry campaign.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Allegedly on the rise, but then so is everybody else.
So is everybody else.
We'll see who dupes it out.
The clown car. There will be a clown getting out of the car soon.
Yes, there will.
And we want to thank Glenn Maxey for getting so early and joining us for this. Glenn's going to be over at Tape Lenders on Cedar Springs. He'll get there around 10 o'clock. He'll be signing his book still about 2 in the afternoon.
It's a great way to meet him. If you're out in the community and you've not met Glenn Maxey, you've missed a real treat and a delight. So come to Tape Lenders and have a conversation, get a book signed.
And Glenn, thanks again for being here with us.